This interview was brought to you by the Omega Center. The Omega Center is an online forum striving to facilitate a deepening of consciousness, conversation, and connection as we seek God in our scientific age. The website is dedicated to education, formation, and inspiration in the converging fields of science and theology, and exists to support the work of author and theologian Ilya Delio.
We are joined today with Professor Dr. John Haught to have a little conversation about his latest blog entry on the Omega Center. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Haught.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
On your latest blog on the Omega Center, you share with us a little bit about your recent book, The New Cosmic Story, Inside Our Awakening Universe.
Right.
You argue that we cannot expect to understand well what is going on in cosmic history apart from a careful examination of what goes on in the interior striving of life that reaches the zenith of its intensity in humanity's spiritual adventures. So you're bringing us into a Teilhardian concept of the universe as having an interiority, a lining of insideness. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about this idea, and how do you link this to religion?
Sure. Well, as everyone who's aware of science knows, over the last two centuries, we've become aware, as never before, that the universe is a process of becoming. It's a story itself. We knew nothing about this until in the last century or so. And we weren't even sure that the universe is a story until the last half of the 20th century. So it's all very, very new. But since we now realize that it's almost as clear as the Earth revolves around the sun that the universe is a work in project, we have new questions. And I think in a way, everything looks different if you now locate it in the context of the cosmic story, including religion, including starting with humanity itself. It used to be thought in religions, especially in Western religions, that somehow or other human minds and souls were planted here or plopped here to do our thing, to undergo a process of transformation, to make us prepared for the next chapter in our journey, hopefully heaven. But what we now know as undeniable science is that humans are also the outcome of a long evolutionary story of life into which we are seamlessly interlaced. And before that, and wider than that, we are part of a long 13.8 billion year cosmic story to which we are also attached, so that we can't really tell our own personal story any longer without telling the story of life that made our existence possible, and without telling, in a sense, the whole cosmic story that made the emergence of human existence, first the emergence of life, but then humans also possible. Now, what has happened as we become aware of this new cosmic story? Something interesting has happened in the humanities, and that's that historians are, at least a few of them, are becoming what we call big historians. They're writing what's called big history. And big history is the attempt to tell, as best it can, everything that has happened in the past, not just in the human story, but in the story of life, and beyond that now, as we know, in the cosmos itself. So that's a very good idea, and it's a really exciting development to talk about history in such big terms. But what I've noticed is that almost all of the so-called advocates of big history are interested primarily in what I like to call the outside story. They emulate scientific method to the extent that they can, and that means to treat things objectively. And that means that, like science itself, they really can't get inside subjects. We now realize, if you look at the cosmos very carefully, that the cosmos has been in the business of bringing about more and more intense versions of psychic or subjective experience. And I would like to locate religion as part of that awakening process, the process whereby the universe has become increasingly conscious of itself by bringing humans along, and before that life, is, I think, best referred to as an awakening universe. And so what my book wants to do is to tell the whole story, not just the outside story, I want to tell that too, of the universe, but the inside story. And the inside story is registered in what we call subjects. Subjects are centers of experience. They have interiority that cannot be communicated in science, but that is clearly there. And the most palpable evidence for that is that each person listening to our conversation just reflect upon what's going on in their own minds, in their own quest for understanding. If they're trying to understand what I'm trying to say here, that's their subjectivity, their intelligent subjectivity. And that's very, very good evidence, therefore, that the universe, since everyone is just as much part of the universe as clouds and pine trees, that their consciousness, our interiority, our subjectivity is just as much part of the universe as anything else. So if you want to understand the universe, you don't follow just the outside story. Yes, you do that, but you also try to get inside the inside story. Mm. And that's not something that our educational systems, that our culture is really good at doing. In fact, a lot of scientific thinkers have a question whether interiority or subjectivity even exists at all. Mm. So if that's how you think, then religious interiority, religious experience, is questionable as any kind of interior experience is. So I'm trying to tell the whole story, and my book is therefore widely empirical. I want to pay attention not just to what science looks at, but to something that science doesn't look at, and that's the inside story of the universe. And that inside story arose gradually. First, matter gave rise to life. It took billions of years for that to happen. Life gave rise to sentience, sentience to consciousness, consciousness to aspirations for truth, meaning, goodness, and beauty. And more recently, there has occurred on this planet, and as far as we know, this is the only place it's going on in the universe, but who knows? We don't know too much about what's going on elsewhere, but we do know, at least on Earth, 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, there was a grand awakening, which the philosopher Karl Jaspers calls the Axial Age. Between 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, in places like Europe and India and China and the Middle East, almost simultaneously, there occurred on our planet a kind of awakening to what I like to call a sense of rightness. In Buddhism, for example, there was an emphasis on finding the right way to think, to pray, to meditate, right mindfulness, right desiring, and so forth. In Greece, in Plato's thought, there was a distinction made between the good and what is not good, between what is right and what is not right. Mm-hmm. And you find similar kinds of thinking in Israel with a prophetic sense that God is looking for righteousness, which means rightness, right mentality. Right religion means practicing justice. The New Testament picks this up. And so all over the planet, at these several places, almost simultaneously, there occurred what I like to call the dawning of rightness, a sense of the reality of rightness, and an aspiration at times even to personalize it and to worship, to bow down before it. Mm. And I consider that, most people consider that, well, that's an interesting anomaly in human history, but I consider the awakening to rightness to be another epoch in the long awakening of the cosmos. So that if we want to understand the universe, we have to pay attention not only to the awakening of life and mind, but also to the awakening to a sense of the transcendence, the indestructibility, the goodness, the unsurpassability of rightness. I use the term rightness as a kind of code word for verbal efficiency to refer to what other philosophers and theologians have called infinite meaning, truth, goodness, and beauty. Rightness is, to me, a word that covers all of that.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground here, so I'm not quite sure where I'm going to start here. But I do feel that it's very interesting the way that you are tackling this idea of objective and subjective truth and experience. And, you know, that even quantum physics or this realm of quantum physics and science are telling us now there is no objective truth. You know, it is all subjective. Everything is impacted by the observer. And so this begins to paint a radically new picture of how we even relate to our surroundings and our reality, which is what I feel you're getting at with this book. In other words, if everything has an interiority to it, then there is essentially no separate objective perspective that is not related to a subjective experience. So everything then becomes part of this relatedness, this ongoing story of relationships that has always been evolving.
Yes. Relationality is a good way, a good word to focus on here, because what we have in modern thought, and this is becoming more and more obvious even in a science, is the fact that to be is to be related to something else. Mm-hmm. So that none of us would have any being at all or actuality at all, apart from the fact that each individual element, atom, molecule, cell, or human organism is synthesizing into itself a wide web of other related beings, so that you can now, instead of speaking as we used to the hierarchy, a vertical static hierarchy of being with matter at the bottom, and then plants, then animals, then human consciousness, then angelic spheres, then God. Instead of thinking in that kind of hierarchy, a static vertical hierarchy, we can now think in terms of a hierarchy of relationships that exists. Mm-hmm. For example, a rock is related to its environment in a minimal sort of way, but a plant is something that puts its roots down into the soil and connects much more intimately to its world. Mm. And when you get to the animal realm, you find organisms that can roam around and form very, very complex relationships within their ecological niche, so that their value, in a sense, is in proportionate to their capacity for relationship. And when we get to human beings, we get to a really fascinating entity in the story of this awakening universe. And that's a kind of being that can form almost an indefinite number of relationships. Mm. We can come up with a whole new notion of freedom as the capacity for relationships. Mm-hmm. So you have a hierarchy of relationships. So then the question becomes, well, what then would God mean in this context? God would be the most absolutely related of all beings. Mm-hmm. What God can relate without any sort of limitation to everything. So that the highest form of being is the deepest form of relationality. And there are hints of this already, I think, in the Trinitarian theology of Christianity, which makes relationality fundamental to the being of God. Yeah. When we go back and when we talk about what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God, it means at the very least to be modeled on that ultimate infinite capacity for relationship. And so that we become ourselves, we realize our freedom, not by isolating ourselves, but by intensifying our relationship to the rest of the world. Mm. That would carry over into our spirituality, too. What used to be said that spirituality has something to do with preparing ourselves for death. Mm. But we should understand death as a kind of escape or departure from relationality. Years ago, the Catholic theologian Karl Rahner suggested that maybe the best way to prepare for death is to cultivate relationships, because mm-hmm. when we die, we take up an even more intimate relationship to, now we know, to the not just the story of life, but to the whole cosmic story. So we get a new eschatology. I said everything looks different now, including what we hope for. What we hope for is we can't think about our own personal destiny apart from hope for the destiny of the whole cosmos.
So much has changed.
All this is as a result of science, as a result of evolutionary biology, cosmology, before that geology, which told us that we're on the move, the universe is on the move. And this is so new to most people, even most theologians, though they might be emotionally aware that we live in this ongoing cosmic story, are not always viscerally or deeply, realistically aware of this or feel it in their bones. You and I both, because of our interest in Teilhard, had a head start. Fortunately, we're fortunate to have that because Teilhard de Chardin was really the first big historian, I think, because he was interested long before anybody else, long before me, and other theologians. He was interested in telling the whole story of the inside as well as the outside. And he used to say that hopefully someday we'll have a new physics, as he put it, that way myself. But what he was saying is we need a new physics which attends our science, and empiricism that attends not just to the outside, but to the inside story. Once you do that, the world gets turned inside out, as it were, and the whole cosmos looks different. And above all, for my purposes, religion looks different.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because like you're saying, this really does change everything. And that hyperphysics that you're talking about, that Teilhard mentions, transforms our sense of you know, our made up boundaries of what is secular and sacred, correct? Because we really are all in this together. And so, as you mentioned, this rise that happened in the first axial religions. Now, I know many scholars talk about us being on the dawn of the second axial age. So in your book, I wonder, where do you see things evolving now as we begin to enter into a more quantum theological perspective in which we are really all interconnected, where God is the ultimate relationality of all relationships? Then how does that transform where our religions might be going?
Well, what I want to do, and here again, I think I'm influenced at least subconsciously by many, many years of reading Teilhard, is to emphasize the future. What the new cosmic story tells us is that the universe has always had something big happening up ahead. For example, if you go back to the time of the Big Bang, let's say you live 300,000 years after the Big Bang, and you looked at the universe in a state it was then, you would see this monotonous plasma of radiation and hydrogen atoms coming into being. And if you had been there, how many of us would ever have anticipated that out of this rather inauspicious beginning would eventually emerge living beings, organisms that are capable of being conscious of themselves, capable of asking the question, what is the meaning of my life? What is it all about? None of us would have done that. But yet, even back at those early stages, and if you go back anywhere in our 13.8 billion year history, go way back, something always big and unpredictable was taking place up ahead. So for example, when you had just plain single-celled beings spread out over this globe that we live on, what was already taking place almost implicitly inside the story was the emergence of organic self-conscious beings. First living beings, then sentient beings, then conscious beings, and then worshiping beings. All these things were taking place up ahead, as it were. So because of this new picture of the universe, what I have adopted as my theological method is what I call an anticipatory reading of the universe. And I contrast that with two other ways of reading the universe. The first one is the what I call the archaeological vision. And that's the reading of the cosmic story, which says if you want to understand the present, go back to the past and then trace imaginatively, step by step, the causal series that led from the remote, simple, elemental past up to the present. That's the archaeological view, and that's the intellectual ideal in our universities all over the world today. There's this tacit assumption that to make things intelligible, you have to break them down into their elemental parts. Teilhard pointed out a long, long time ago that if you look at that way of understanding the world, yes, it's good for science to do this. Science should break things down analytically. But to understand what's going on now, it's not enough simply to break things down into their elemental components, because the farther back you go in cosmic history, or the further down you go in analyzing organisms and other things, the more the elements start spreading apart into dispersal and incoherence. In other words, you end up with a mound of sand. And the archaeological reading is content with that. But the problem with that is that it makes the past the most real phase or state of being. And what I want to do is follow the more biblical or Abrahamic perspective, where the future is all important. And this is what happened in Teilhard's own experience, that the more he looked into the past as a geologist, the more he realized that he wasn't being satisfied. He wasn't finding what he was looking for, meaning or intelligibility. It was only after he turned around, after digging back into the past and looked toward the future, it was only then that he found what he was looking for. And he increasingly referred to himself as a pilgrim from the future who's made a long, long journey into the past, but now wants to return toward the future. The future is the really real in the anticipatory vision. So how do you face the future? How do you face reality if you follow the anticipatory approach? You do so by adopting the posture of hope. It's only through hope that we let the future in. Whereas the archaeological vision that I was just talking about, by idealizing the past, ends up with a pessimistic view of things.
That's right.
Life and mind and everything else that happens is eventually headed for the entropic absolute apocalypse where everything falls apart into complete dismemberment and unintelligibility. So you have those two views. You have the archaeological view, which is very popular in the intellectual world, and you have the anticipatory view, which is the Abrahamic view. But the anticipatory view got lost through much of Christian history because of our flirtation with Greek philosophy.
It's a very strong flirtation.
Yeah, very strong, and it's still very much alive, so much so that Nietzsche once, in his criticism of Christianity, said Christianity is merely Platonism for the people.
That's right.
There's a sense of truth to that. I don't want to exaggerate that point, because all throughout Christian history, the Bible has been there, but it's only been there out of the corner of our eye. This anticipatory vision was not really something we could focus on, I don't believe, until science came along. And this is the great gift of this new cosmic story of the sense of evolution, the sense of process, that it opens up the future in a way that past science, past philosophy, and past theology did not. So the Greek influence made our theology what I like to call an analogical way of reading things. Everything down here below is a more or less perfect or imperfect replica, analogy, or representation of the perfect world that exists up above in the mind of God. So within an analogical spirituality, the point of your life, and I don't want to disparage this because it gave meaning to the lives of many people up until recently, the meaning of life is to detach yourself from the various levels of the hierarchy so that you will be in a position, so you will have undergone a transformation process that will allow you to be one with the eternal, changeless, timeless deity. So time was disparaged. Time really had very little value in the analogical view. But what happened once science came along is that a new horizon opened up for the world. We began to realize that there's a future for this world. And so, as Teilhard puts it, there came to exist in the heart of almost all of us what he called the problem of the two faiths. the problem is whether to believe in the analogical world of perfection up above and detach ourselves from the world and not worry too much about what happens in time or what the outcome of human history, let alone the outcome of the cosmos, would be. Detach our souls from this world so as to come into climactic communion with God. It's a beautiful vision, and it's one that still dominates in the Christian world, but it's one that fails to take into account something really exciting that's happened in the world of science, and that's the rediscovery of time.
Yes.
Time, something happens in time. The world can grow from state A to state B in such a way that time becomes meaningful. And now we realize that we ourselves are part of this temporal becoming process of narrative, dramatic unfolding. It raises new questions about what the meaning of our lives would be. And so what I do in my book, I have 12 chapters, and each chapter takes a specific component of religion and tries to show or to suggest what that traditional understanding of religion, sort of transcendence, indestructibility, symbolism, purpose, happiness, wrongness and rightness, and so forth. What do all these mean in the context of a universe that's still coming into being? Because if a universe is still coming into being, it's not yet fully actual. If it's not yet fully actual, it's not yet fully intelligible. So the only way we can make sense of the universe is the way we make sense of a story. We keep reading. We don't stop reading after the first two chapters. Take a great novel, for example, The Brothers Karamazov or something like that. You get very discouraged after the first 15, maybe 20, maybe even 30 chapters. So much is happening, you haven't put it together yet. There's no coherence. So what I propose is we look not just for analytic simplification, but to make sense of things, look for narrative coherence. Keep reading. And as you move further and further into the novel or story, whatever you're reading, things that were earlier unrelated start coming together in a kind of coherence that could not have been anticipated unless you kept waiting, reading patiently, looking toward the horizon of what is to come. And that's the basis, I think, for the kind of spirituality that Christianity, and not just Christianity, but eventually other faiths, need, because all the religions of the world are right now pretty much, for the most part, at least most members, are not really aware of what science has now taught us about a universe that's still coming into being.
That's right.
So what I propose in the book is a new basis for interreligious discussion as well, in which we all walk hand in hand and anticipate the fuller awakening of the universe, because the universe is not yet very awake in religion. Part of this awakening, but religion too shares in the imperfection of a process which has not yet reached completion. So there's in the book I talk about the wrongness in religion as well as the rightness that first came to full consciousness in the axial period.
Yeah, and this is one of Teilhard's major critiques of religion as well, which is that, you know, it's ceased to animate the zest for living. And in so many ways, Christianity, as you're describing, has lost its entire incarnational premise by being, as you said, so influenced by Platonic thinking, but also this emphasis of the archaeological perspective that you're naming, which is that we tend to look back into the past and glorify the past, and that limits our understanding of how we are presently participating in welcoming the future.
Yeah.
And so we've lost that within our tradition. And
we have, very much so. And what we've lost is the way in which the Israelites looked back. I mean, all of us have to look back into our history. But what do you look for? You don't look to repristinate some ideal golden age. But what a good anticipatory spirituality would do, yes, let's go back by all means, but let's look at how they, at their time, anticipated something new arising up ahead. And what we gain from them is faith. What I mean by faith is allowing ourselves to be grasped by what is coming. So anticipation is just another word for faith. For faith, you might say, is the style or mode of consciousness that anticipation takes when it becomes conscious of itself in humans. We now realize that we live in a universe that has always been anticipating something new up ahead. And when humans come along, the way in which we connect both to the universe is to adopt this posture of anticipation.
Yeah, and that's profound too in the ways that I think about the religious role of remembrance, that we tend to think about this as just to look back into the past, but recollection and remembrance, I like to think of it as being membered to the wholeness of things.
Yes,
in other words, it's not a sentimentality about the past, but rather a sense of the wholeness that we all participate in and belong to, so that we can then make space for, creatively midwife, what is wanting to come.
The only thing I would add to that, and here's where I guess my spirituality is different from a number of other science-conscious people today, is I want to emphasize that this wholeness of which you're talking, and it's is something that is not yet already waiting there, fully finished, as it were, and we tap into it. Because that's another version of what I call the analogical reading of things. The wholeness, as I understand it, is something that has never yet been fully actualized. But this comes back to Teilhard's point about the zest for living. The zest for living requires, he thinks, and I believe he's right about this, a sense that our lives are making a difference in terms of the whole that has not yet fully come into being. And I'm going to say something here that might sound a little bit heretical from an analogical perspective, but it's one that anticipatory thinkers like Teilhard and then in the Protestant world, Wolfhart Pannenberg and others are maintaining that there's a very realistic sense in which we can understand God as in some way not yet. And this is in no way a diminishment of divine omnipotence or divine omnipresence or divine infinity. In fact, it brings a vulnerability into our sense of God. That God allows the divine self to be somewhat textured by what happens in the creation that God has made incarnate in his own life. And by entering into the flesh of the cosmos, God takes the cosmos, and not just human beings, because now we realize that our existence is continuous with this whole cosmic story. In the incarnation, God takes the whole cosmic process into the divine self and is interested that that world become such as to be able to open itself fully to the implantation of the infinite love of God. And that's a process. It's a process. But evolution, cosmology, and other sciences have reshaped our understanding of nature in such a way that from henceforth we have to understand the divine incarnation in a much richer way than we have in the past.
That's right. So again, it brings that idea of the continual incarnation.
Yes.
So that Panikkar talks about and others talk about, but this, this idea of God becoming, there's something so, like you said, there's something so profoundly intimate and vulnerable about this idea of God, that we are participating in God. That, I mean, even terms within our own liturgy and our own scriptures of we are the body of Christ then take on a whole new meaning. And I'm thinking in particular, too, about the relationship between this theological perspective with what we know about science and time that hasn't seemed to filter into our theology yet, which is, the ways that we're still using causality. A caused B and then B caused C. And that's, what we know about science is that that's not really an accurate picture of time. And even in quantum physics, they're saying that the effect creates the cause. And that messes with our brains because we're really used to linear thinking. But this is not a linear process.
Well, it's something that science, too, is going to have to rethink, because scientists are increasingly becoming aware of what they call emergence. That we live in a universe in which new ordering principles somehow arise in a way that cannot be predicted or understood simply by way of analyzing the past. Mm-hmm. So along with the renewal of spirituality in the religious world, there has to be undergone intellectual transformation in science and eventually in philosophy and epistemology and our understanding of what knowing itself is. That is only barely beginning. But it sets the agenda for a future, both for the human reason, for the human mind, but also for the human heart and the human spirit, in which some very interesting things, I think, can happen up ahead. So what I try to do in my book, The New Cosmic Story, with the subtitle of which is Inside Our Awakening Universe, is to try to acclimatize spirituality, not just Christian, mm-hmm. all religion, mm-hmm. to this new universe in the process of becoming. And that means we have to shift our metaphors mm-hmm. from understanding the universe as a machine made up of interesting complex forms of design, which had traditionally pointed our minds toward deity. We now understand what's the real question. It's not whether design points to deity. We got bogged down in that question for so many years, and we still are too bogged down in that. The question is not whether design points to deity, but whether this drama, this cosmic drama, carries a meaning. Mm. It shifts the whole science and religion discussion away from kind of dead ends, excuse me, that have existed for a long time, into a more interesting question of what's really going on in the universe. Mm-hmm. And if the universe is a story, we realize a story can be read or understood at many different levels. And these levels do not have to contradict one another. Mm. So science can read the story from the point of view of abstract physical laws. Mm-hmm. But when you read the drama from a religious point of view, what science calls laws now become more like rules of grammar that the drama has to adhere to in order to come up with new meaning as the drama moves forward mm-hmm. into the mystery of the future, which I like to call God.
Mm, yeah, we are always, aren't we, looking for ways to concretize or name the ineffable experience of this objectless sense of intimacy in our cosmos. And that's what I feel I'm getting from where your book is going. And I'm so grateful to your work. And this sounds like such an amazing adventure. I look forward to diving in. And I like to end a lot of these interviews with a practical question, which is, what practices do you engage in that help you connect with that sense of interiority or foster it or deepen it in your own life?
That's an excellent question. I try to meditate in an anticipatory way. What meditation is for me is not the same thing as contemplation of the perfect ideal world beyond, but my spirituality has turned into something almost indistinguishable from anticipation, that is mm-hmm. hope. But even more practically speaking, as a Catholic, as a result of this new way of thinking about the cosmos, when I go to Mass with my fellow Catholics on Sunday, the Eucharist means something so much different now from what it did before mm-hmm. I got into discussions of evolution and cosmology. Mm-hmm. And to me, it becomes so much more beautiful. And I just recommend to any listeners that if they haven't read Teilhard's Mass on the World, it can be a mind-blowing experience and can bring them into this kind of meditative, anticipatory way of looking at faith, of God, at Christ, in a way that very few pieces of spiritual writing have been able to do.
Mm. Thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. We are so grateful and to your contributions to the Omega Center and also to your contributions to the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bree. I appreciate being here.